Food Today, science-based information on food, nutrition and safety. From UFIC, the European Food Information Council. In May 2013, the 20th European Congress on Obesity, hosted by the European Association for the Study of Obesity, EASO, took place in Liverpool. With the prevalence of obesity still on the rise, the objectives of this annual forum are to communicate the state-of-the-art research in the field of obesity, to foster innovative approaches for the prevention and treatment of obesity and its associated burden of diseases, and to bring together experts in the field of obesity research and management. The programme drew over 1,700 participants and covered a range of obesity-related topics. UFIC interviewed 10 of the speakers at the conference, who summarised their research findings. A topic discussed in several talks at the conference was public health interventions, the related challenges and approaches that have shown promising results. Paul Sasher is a senior research fellow at University College London, an honorary principal dietitian at Great Ormond Street Hospital for Children in London, and research director of the MEND project. There's a clear need for interventions that are clinically effective, feasible, and commercially viable. Paul describes how the MEND initiative fulfills these criteria.
MEND is a multi-component, family-based child weight management program that's delivered in local communities to families in order to address behaviours that are associated with obesity. It's been designed specifically for children who are already overweight or obese or at risk of becoming overweight or obese. So it's multi-component. It includes nutrition, physical activity and behaviour change, all delivered in a way that's engaging, practical and fun in order to help families to make sustainable lifestyle changes to improve the whole family's health. What's really positive about MEND is that the real-world evaluations have shown very similar reductions in BMI compared to the randomized control trial when delivered to many thousands of families. Also, MEND in the UK has shown that MEND works for all demographics, all ethnic groups and social classes, producing significant BMI reductions and therefore does not widen health inequalities, which is obviously a crucial element for scaling up a public health intervention.
What is it that makes MEND an effective intervention?
One of the reasons why MEND has been so successful is that we've really brought together experts from the worlds of academia, clinical practice, commercial sector, really looking at how we can both develop clinically effective programs that can be delivered at scale using some of the tools from sort of large-scale rollouts of cars and other manufacturing industries, and also ensuring that programs are financially sustainable. And in order to achieve impact, you really need to integrate the components of clinical, operational, and commercial in order to achieve impact. And I think that's one of the fundamental reasons why MEND has been able to develop not only effective programs, but to operationalize them at scale and also to generate revenue in order to provide the programs free to families. Because to date, no family has ever paid to attend one of our programs, because we know that for many families who need these programs most, are often the families that can least afford to pay for it.
How are you evaluating the impact of MEND and what are the results so far?
MEND has been evaluated using a range of methodologies, including randomized control trials, feasibilities, pilots, longitudinal evaluations, system dynamics, cost-effective analysis, population-level evaluations, and scale-up and spread studies. And all of these different types of evaluations have really contributed to us developing a much better understanding of how to deliver clinically effective programs at scale in local communities, in international and very diverse settings. The holy grail of weight management is we know we can get children, adults to lose weight, but it's about keeping the weight off or maintaining a healthy lifestyle for life. And the evaluation we've just concluded has shown that in 55% of children, 2.5 years post-intervention, have still reduced their BMI Z-score, which is obviously a very significant finding and which shows that these types of interventions can have long-lasting effects.
Do you have any advice for future interventions?
First of all, what I would say to anyone embarking in this field is really to think about the longer term vision for their intervention, to think about what happens when your grant funding runs out, how is your program going to be commercially sustainable, and to really start to think about how you can standardize it so that other people can deliver it. Because if it's just one program being delivered in one place by one person, although that may be useful to you in your clinical practice, unfortunately, due to the scale of the problem, we need interventions that can be rolled out on an industrial scale. And that's really what we've tried to do with MEND. So looking at the long-term vision, I think, is key when you're starting out in this field.
Chris Holmes works on developing consumer products and services that, by making use of his commercial marketing experiences, aim to address public health issues. He was previously leading the programme for the UK Department of Health that became the Change for Life campaign. He says that a major problem is the lack of sustainability in current public health interventions.
I think the challenge there at the moment is that we don't actually have a lot of evidence of what works. We've got interventions that have modest effect sizes on the problems we're doing. So we're really in a very creative phase of developing interventions. And those interventions need to be systemic. They need to be influencing multiple aspects of the problem at the same time. And at the moment, mainly we're delivering interventions one at a time in community contexts. And so they're not pushing, if you like, all the relevant buttons to achieve the outcomes we want. And the biggest difficulty we're facing at the moment is really sustaining those interventions so that we can improve them and develop them. Where we are at the moment is that we maybe get funding for a year. We use a significant amount of that funding to fund the fixed costs of setting up an intervention. It runs for 6-9 months. It then stops because there's no further funding. We haven't built an emotional relationship with the users of that service, nor have we developed the wealth of knowledge in order to be able to then go on and improve it. So it really is about this sustainability unlocks a number of opportunities in the way we manage and develop interventions into the future.
How do you think we can make public health interventions sustainable?
I've spent some 15 years working in commercial marketing, and then I stepped across to work in the public sector to try and apply the same ideas to social issues. And I've come to learn through both of those pieces of experience that actually we need to borrow aspects of the commercial approach, which is about emotion and empathy with consumers and issues of scale, and put that together with the scientific evidence and the behavioural science that underpins the public sector approach. And that's probably where sustainable solutions lie. And I think we do need to now find models where the interventions that we're designing themselves generate sustainable funds that continue their operation. I think the profit motive is actually a good motive. The challenge for me is the ethics by which we generate those profits and then the use we put them to subsequently, in terms of reinvesting in sustaining and developing interventions on social issues.
One of your current projects integrates IT technology in mobile phones with physical activity and education. Can you explain this a bit further?
Historically, screens have been something that has had to sit in the corner of the living room, a television, or sit on the desk, a computer. Now screens are mobile, and that gives us a great opportunity to effectively get children active with their screens. What we're seeing also from a lot of the work that's going on in terms of physical activity interventions is that the number of people who are intrinsically motivated by physical activity, and by that I mean get fun out of being physically active, is quite limited. So what we have to do is to find the things that people are interested in and design interventions in such a way that we use those interests to get them out and engaging, and they are incidentally active, effectively active purely by chance, although we've carefully designed it to be so.
Could you illustrate this with an example?
One of the ideas is, let's take the issue of nature and wildlife documentaries. Here in the UK, we've got a long heritage, obviously developed by Sir David Attenborough, of people getting very interested in wildlife documentary. But of course, that's historically been on the television in the corner of your room. So if wildlife documentary brought nature into people's living rooms, can we use mobile technology to take people back out to nature? So the idea is, at the moment that we're working up, is to develop a system that is effectively a treasure map. that people can use to find locations that have been set up by organisations such as the Wildlife Trusts or the National Parks, where people can encounter interesting wildlife. So, for example, rock pools on a beach. They use the treasure map to navigate their way to that rock pool, find the animal that's the focus, and at that point we serve them on their mobile phone the interesting little bit of mini documentary that gives an interesting insight into the life and the behaviours of that particular animal. They answer some questions about that, and that unlocks the clue to the next location on their treasure map to look at. And of course, in doing that, effectively, they're being more active. There's lots of different ways to tap into what people inherently are interested in, rather than us, as we do try to do at the moment, is make them interested in being physically active. And the reality is that that's only a small proportion of people want to do that.
A relatively novel approach to public health interventions aiming to change behaviour, and something that's gaining increasing interest by both scientists and policymakers, is nudging. Teresa Marto works at the University of Cambridge and is director of the Behaviour and Health Research Unit. Professor Marto and her colleagues conducted a large-scale review in the field of nudging or choice architecture.
The concept of nudging or choice architecture first came to public awareness with the publication of the book of the same title, Nudging, in 2008. So it's based on the simple idea that much of our behaviour is cued by the environment. So the book starts with the example of a cafeteria, and if fruit salad is placed nearer to where the customer is approaching the line, then they're more likely to choose that than chocolate cake if it's placed on a higher shelf. So by changing the structure of situations, environments in which we make choices, you can shape the choices that people make.
Can you tell us a bit more about the study you did?
The large-scale review that we conducted in Cambridge, led by Gareth Hollands and Ian Shemelt, involved going to the literature and asking some quite basic questions to find, in the end, 346 relevant articles. We were able to map across the four different behaviour types we were interested in, and we discovered that the majority of the research had been conducted in diet-related behaviours, so around 70% of the studies were in that area. Around 20% focused on increasing or decreasing, but shaping physical activity, and far less on alcohol and tobacco.
You provided us with some examples of single studies in this field. Which of these are promising from the perspective of their effect size, their feasibility and long-term effect?
It's a very good question. And as I made clear in the presentation, with our scoping review, we didn't look, it wasn't designed to look at what seems to be most effective. But if I were asked to say which I thought were most promising, I would go for sizing. People are very sensitive to the size of portions that are presented to them, whether that's for food, possibly also for alcohol as well. And they're sensitive to the size of the tableware in which foods are presented as well. So I go for sizing. I'd also go for availability. These would be studies that have looked, for example, at the content of foods in a vending machine. So if you change the content so that it's healthier, then people will select the healthier items. And also proximity. People in the main are very efficient at conserving energy. So the easier something is to obtain, the more likely they are to go for it, even down to seemingly very simple movements, so that people will be more likely to select a salad in a salad bar arrangement that is immediately close to them, rather than stretching just another few more centimetres to help themselves to something that is at arm's length. So those would be the three.
Regarding portion sizes, finding the right size may be a challenge, since you want to avoid people taking a second portion after not being satisfied with the first. What are your views on that?
Yes, it's a very good observation. One of the key questions in the area, I think, is how small can you go before you actually increase the amount that people will help themselves to? in the systematic review that we're conducting on sizing, obviously we're dependent on the evidence that's already been generated. And indeed, this is one of the components that we will be looking at. If there's an absence of evidence on that issue about the extent to which sizing is linear or not, then this will point us in the direction of an absence of evidence requiring more primary research.
Evaluating the impact of an intervention is key to knowing how successful the approach was, and importantly, if it was cost-effective. For interventions that aim to reduce the risk for a disease developing later in life, simulation models may be used. Winifred Paulus is a PhD student at the Erasmus Medical Center in Rotterdam, the Netherlands. She's reviewed the scientific literature concerning intervention studies that focused on weight reduction and the effect on quality of life. By using the data from these studies, she used mathematical models to calculate the cost-effectiveness of these interventions. She explains.
We conducted a systematic review to determine if multidisciplinary interventions for the management of childhood obesity improve quality of life and if they are cost-effective. Studies were included if they were RCTs and studied multidisciplinary programs, if they studied overweight or obese children and reported quality of life and or cost. Finally, 11 studies were included in our review. And we extracted the data, pooled the studies that reported quality of life and determined the cost effectiveness with some models.
What kind of models did you use?
We determined the cost effectiveness with the Hollingworth model, published in the International Journal of Obesity of 2012. He estimated the direct medical costs that are saved when a child loses weight. So there are medical costs associated with diabetes, with coronary heart disease, with a stroke and certain types of cancers. And how much would the incidence of these diseases decrease if a child loses weight? And how much money would save that? So that's a model he calculated. And we could compare the effect sizes on BMI of the studies included in our review and the cost of the programs of our review. And we compared that with a model, and that's how we determined cost effectiveness.
Models that look at future disease incidence to calculate cost effectiveness are based on certain assumptions. Can you tell us a bit more about the assumptions and about the validity of the results?
The models are indeed based on several assumptions. One is a big assumption is that the weight reduction in children will remain. Other assumptions are the medical costs are only based on five big diseases, but there are so much more diseases associated with obesity. For example, osteoarthritis, very common and associated with obesity, and the savings in that disease were not encountered. And these are the costs at this moment in 2012. We don't know what will happen with the medical costs in the future. And these are only medical costs saved. We know, for example, that obese adults show more absenteeism and less productivity at work. And it could be that if children lose weight, they will become less obese adults or no obese adults and show more productivity at work. And this will lead to extra savings as well. And that's not in the model. And I think this model is conservative and very careful. And we finally found that 2 out of 3 multidisciplinary interventions are cost effective.
Did you have any recommendations for future interventions in this field?
One surprising thing was we found more than 2,000 articles and only 11 studies could be included in our study because so little studies report quality of life and the cost of their intervention. And I think it's really important to know what the cost of an intervention was. So I would recommend at least to report the cost of the interventions and measure quality of life if possible.
Laura Weber is a research associate at the UK National Heart Forum in London. Funded by the UK Health Forum, she's used simulation models to predict future impact of obesity on the development of dementia up to 2050. Could you tell us a bit more about the research and models you've used?
Both obesity and dementia are global public health issues. Dementia globally affects around 35 million people, And in the UK, there are currently around 800,000 people suffering from dementia at a total cost of £23 billion per year. I focused on obesity, and it's actually midlife obesity, so between the ages of 40 to 59 approximately, that confers an increased risk of dementia later in life. So there's around a 25-year time lag. We used a computer model of a simulated population to model around 10 million individuals. The model specifically targets the relationship between individuals' changing risk factors and disease incidence. The risk factor distributions were determined by predictions and specified health interventions. So we were able to model the impact of cost and various public health interventions. There's a second part to the model, which includes disease incidence, mortality, survival, and relative risk data, as well as population data. So we used the projected BMI data to simulate a future incidence of disease based on the relative risk connecting obesity to dementia. The models, they're very data heavy. They include population data, so birth statistics, death statistics, fertility rates, a number of males and females in the population. And the simulated population is based on those population statistics in England. It also includes a large series of BMI data, and then it includes not just dementia in the model, it includes other diseases. So it includes a time series, so we're able to look at simulated changes in behaviour over time, and that's what gives us the projections. And we can do it to any decade, but predictions obviously get less accurate the more you project into the future. We found that the projected prevalence of obesity-related dementia in the over-65s increased by around 30% from 2010 to 2050.
Surprisingly, you found that with a simulated decreased body mass index, there was actually an increase in dementia. Can you explain this?
We were able to simulate an intervention that reduced population BMI in 2010 by 5%. To see what impact that would have on future rates of dementia. And initially that would actually increase rates of dementia because people within the model would be surviving of other diseases, such as heart disease, cancer. So they would be living longer and developing dementia. Then we were able to model the avoidable costs of dementia if there were effective interventions that were able to reduce obesity. So a 5% reduction in BMI would result in an avoidable cost of around £600 million in 2050, and that's in 1 year.
You mentioned that these are preliminary results. Are you going to do more analyses?
It was an exploratory analysis funded by the UK Health Forum. We'd like to do some more work in this area. It would be important to look at other risk factors as well. We have a tobacco model and we're building physical activity and alcohol models. And it would be good to somehow combine those risk factors and look at the combined impact of lifestyle risk factors on future incidence of dementia. We can also model these things in different countries, provided there are data available. And then looking at these impacts on different groups. So I haven't looked at sex differences or ethnic differences.
Trying to change lifestyle-related behaviours has shown to be difficult, even when these behaviours are increasing the risk for serious diseases. The adoption of some of these behaviours stems from an early age, and parents have an important role to play. Pedro Teixeira is a professor and director of the Physical Activity, Nutrition and Obesity Research Group at the Technical University of Lisbon. His research is centred on behavioural issues related to obesity and physical activity. At the conference, Professor Teixeira presented the Spotlight Project, an EU-funded initiative.
The key word for the project is really integrated, because unlike other projects, it focuses on behaviour change in the context of obesity, but looking at it from multiple perspectives. And those include environmental determinants, multi-level interventions that are already in place, evaluating those, but also individual level variables that might be involved in explaining how some people change behavior or explaining how is it easier to create future interventions that are more successful in helping obese individuals or individuals at risk to change their behavior. The goal is really to find out determinants of behavior from multiple perspectives, to integrate those into recommendations to design interventions in the future.
You've conducted a scientific literature review on previous interventions. Can you tell us a bit more about this work and your findings?
Within this project, my university was responsible for looking at variables, typically psychosocial variables, that have been tested in previous interventions and that have been found to mediate or to explain the effect of those interventions on three key outcomes. And those are weight change, physical activity, or fat or energy intake. What we have found so far, for instance, for dietary behaviors, that appears to be particularly important to include the training of self-regulation skills like self-monitoring, self-planning, making action plans, identifying key problems and solving those problems. Another variable that comes up a lot in the literature is self-efficacy, or the extent to which you feel confident that you will be able to reach your goals. Interestingly, for dietary behaviors, it doesn't appear to be that important, meaning that perhaps it's really about the skills that you need to develop for those particular behaviors, because the environment is so complex. It's not so much about you feeling confident or you having the right motivation to do it. It's more about developing certain skills that you can learn to better navigate this obesogenic environment.
What did you find for the other two outcomes that you looked at, weight change and physical activity?
For weight and physical activity, we identified a different set of variables that are perhaps most promising for future interventions. Among those, one that has come up as particularly consistent was a motivational variable that describes the quality of motivation, whether you're rightly motivated. And what I mean by this is to the degree to which you self-endorse the reasons for physical activity or for losing weight. So, for instance, for physical activity, it might be things like recognizing its importance for your health or for your well-being. It might be things very much related to the experience of physical activity, what we usually call intrinsic motivation. So if you have fun doing the activity, if it allows you to be with people that are meaningful to you, if you develop new capacities, new skills, if it allows you to face new challenges, physical challenges or otherwise, those are things that are very important to keep you in progress when the goal is to increase the level of physical activity. Two other variables that were particularly interesting for weight control in particular, because they are often forgotten, are body image on one hand, and on the other hand, having a flexible approach to eating control. So those variables also came up as autonomous motivation and as self-regulation skills. It's interesting because both body image and having a flexible approach to your behavioral regulation are also linked with the type of motives and goals that you're trying to achieve. So it makes sense that autonomous motivation, positive body image, and a flexible control over eating came together as a set of predictors that are particularly well positioned in terms of our data to predict outcomes such as weight control and physical activity.
Could you tell us a bit more about body image?
Some of the findings we've produced on that level point not so much to the perceptual importance or the perceptual elements of body image in which you might perceive that your body is different than what it exactly is, but one of the critical elements that have come through our research is how much of one's self-esteem is invested in one's body image. So there's a dimension of body image which is called an investment dimension. And that dimension can be more adaptive, more healthy, more flexible, or it can be more dysfunctional, in which you have a very rigid sort of appraisal of your body. And if much of your self-esteem is physical self-esteem, so everything is dependent on your body size, that's what we call dysfunctional investment. That's when other problems and well-being is severely affected. And so there are ways in which health professionals can put body appreciation in relative terms so that the investment is a positive one which appreciates the uniqueness of one's body at any weight, and it minimizes the comparison aspects of having to be a certain shape or size like society tells us that we should.
You mentioned people's flexible approach to eating control or eating restraint described two distinct patterns. Can you explain these?
The scale that has been used for eating restraint has actually two dimensions or two aspects of it. One is a more rigid pattern of eating regulation, and another one represents a more flexible pattern of eating regulation. It's a more nuanced perspective. It's not such a black or white perspective in which if something goes wrong, well, everything goes wrong, I have to make everything right, I cannot eat the forbidden food. That's a more rigid pattern. A more flexible pattern is usually with items such as when I eat a bit more in one day, I can compensate the next day without a problem, or I don't stress too much if my diet fluctuates and it's not exactly perfect. So it's a more flexible, nuanced approach to eating control, which we have found before that is predictive of better weight loss. It is also more associated with physical activity, which is interesting because it might help people that have a more flexible eating pattern. It may be because they are physically active, so they know that they can compensate whatever doesn't go as perfectly in one's diet with a bit more physical activity the next day, and that will be okay. So it's a more long-term approach to one's diet, and it's not so much dependent on what exactly is going wrong and right today. A flexible pattern allows for fluctuations in how well we regulate. It's a positive finding, I think, in terms of helping health professionals and interventions to conceptualize dietary prescription in a more balanced way and in not so much rigid ways. For instance, counting calories, even though it can be useful, it can also be very obsessive and lead to very strict and very rigid control over one's diet.
Julie Vanawala is a PhD student at the Department of Developmental, Personality and Social Psychology at Ghent University. She does research on eating behavior in children, with a focus on emotional eating in obese youngsters. Parents have an important role to play.
Well, research has shown that parents have a lot of influence on eating behavior of the child because parents are the caregiver and have influences on what the child eats, how much the child eats, when the child eats, and so on. But even when children get older, parents still have influence. For example, parents model, parents eat vegetables, fruits. If they have a fridge full of fruits and vegetables, children are more easily going to eat fruit and vegetables. So I think parents have a very important influences on the eating behavior of children.
You've carried out a study on obese children that were on a waiting list for a year of inpatient treatment in Belgium. You inquired about their eating behavior. What sort of questions did you ask, and what were your findings?
We asked them to fill in some questionnaires about their eating behavior. We looked at the emotional eating of a child, so eating in response to negative emotions. And we also asked them to fill in a questionnaire about maternal rejection. For example, is your mother favoring another sibling above you? Do you feel that you are the black sheep of the family? And we also asked the mother to fill in a questionnaire about her feeding behavior. So the demandingness dimension and the responsiveness dimension. What we found is that responsive feeding behavior of the mother is related to more emotional eating of the youngsters if there is a negative family climate. If there is a positive family climate, responsive feeding behavior of the mother is related to less emotional eating of the youngsters. So we found an interaction. Normally we say responsiveness in the feeding domain is very good. If parents show a lot of responsiveness, if they, for example, ask the child at mealtimes, is it good? Do you enjoy the food? This is normally positive. But we see if general family climate is negative and parents show a lot of involvement concerning foods, is it good? Is it okay? And this is related to more emotional eating of youngsters. In general, they are very dismissive of the child, show not a lot of support, but when it comes to food, they show a lot of involvement. And this is maybe a mixed message, and this is the problem, I think, because in general, they're not involved. They only are involved when it comes to food.
In your presentation, you mentioned parental control and the importance of how parents control their child's eating behavior. Can you tell us a bit more and give some advice for parents?
First, studies focused on parental demandingness, and this is how much parents use control. And so they could not find a definite conclusion. So some researchers found that too much control leads to more disturbed eating. For example, parents who pressure the child to empty their plate, this could lead to the child overeating. But also some researchers have found that a lack of control can also lead to disturbed eating. So there was not really a definite conclusion, and the researcher Hughes has found that if control is done in a responsive way, this has a better outcome on childhood obesity and disturbed eating than control in a non-responsive manner. For example, if a parent says, empty your plate, no further description, this is a different way than, for example, a parent asking their child to empty their plate and giving a good reason. For example, would you eat your vegetables because this is important for your health? And so this is a different manner to use control than, for example, just saying you have to do this without any further explanation. Previous research has shown that it's important to have the parents involved. Parents should also look more healthy. They should also do more exercises so that the involvement is better. But I think if the atmosphere or the emotional climate is still negative, then maybe this won't work or work as we want it to work. So I think the message is that it's not enough to just look at eating behavior or feeding behavior or physical activity. It's also important for parents to really support their children and to accept their children, because if parents are not accepting of their children, I think this will have a negative effect on the treatment.
BMI, the body mass index, is often used as a measure for indicating one's risk for cardiovascular and other metabolic diseases. But is this an adequate approach? Professor Hermann Toplak works at the University of Graz and is also the current president-elect at the European Association for the Study on Obesity. In his presentation, Professor Toplak addressed the shortcomings of the body mass index when used as a single measure for cardiovascular disease risk.
Some years ago, we have learned that BMI is associated to cardiovascular mortality. But in the last years, we have a big change in the development of the society. We have a mixture of people moving and not moving. And the interesting thing behind that is that those who do not exercise have less muscle and seem to be normal weight. To find measures, therefore, it's rather complicated, given the fact that we have so different people to judge. Not one size fits all. So we can take the BMI, and it's a crude measure at first. If we look at the waist or measure it, we can realize that we have a visceral fat distribution and not necessarily a high BMI. We have a lot of normal weight people who have so few muscles that they even seem not to have a waist, but they can easily have 30-34% fat, meaning that they are really fattened. The muscle-fat relation is very bad, and therefore they have to be treated.
So, in other words, people may seem to be lean and even have a waist circumference that is not associated with being at risk, but at the same time have a relatively high percentage of body fat. What do you think is currently the best method to measure body composition that is both cost-effective and practical in terms of usage?
As soon as we measure BMI, waist, and perhaps waist-to-hip and waist-to-height ratio, and then go, for example, for a beer measurement, which is quite easily done today, then we have at least a rough estimate of body fattening. Might not be very accurate, but this is the case with every clinical measurement we do.
Combining these different measures thus gives a better indication for the risk of cardiovascular disease by estimating the body composition. Could you tell what information the body impedance measurement provides?
Body impedance measurement is giving you information in relation to weight, sex, age, and the regression scales, and you measure just the resistance in the electrical field, and it gives you some information about the water and fat content.
Jean-Michel Aupert is professor of nutrition at University Pierre et Marie Curie and also works at the Department of Nutrition in the Hospital Pitié-Salpêtrière in Paris. Professor, you've pointed out the importance of comorbidities next to overweight as an indicator for the mortality risk. Can you detail this a bit further?
There is increasing evidence showing that in some instances, overweight itself is not associated with increased mortality. And so I think it's important to keep in mind that the deleterious effects are mostly seen in the obese or severely obese patients. And for those who are less severely obese, it's when they have comorbidities associated with overweight or moderate obesity that you can see an effect on mortality. So this gives specific type of individuals to focus on, either those with relatively severe obesity or those with less severe obesity but with comorbidities.
Can you give some examples of the comorbidities that you are referring to and how these may affect treatment?
You have metabolic problems. The first one is type 2 diabetes, but there are other metabolic problems like dyslipidemia, hypertension. Then you have cardiovascular disease, you have sleep apnea, you have joint problems, and many others. I really think that treatment should focus on the real, on the severe obese cases, or on the less severe obese cases, but with comorbidities. The treatment of these diseases when they exist. There is really a need to define what are the goals, what are the criteria for success, what is the risk-benefit balance, and to redefine the strategy that we will use.
It's well known that weight loss can improve a number of factors of metabolic health. However, there are particular cases, as you've explained to us, in which weight loss may not be beneficial for health. Can you take us through the cases that you've mentioned today?
Sometimes weight loss may be bad. This may depend on a number of factors, which are first the intention to lose weight, this is very important, the composition of the weight loss, perhaps the location of the weight loss, but it's not so well known, and also the method used for weight loss. So for intention, of course, we know that if weight loss is non-intentional, it really means that there must be an underlying disease, and this is of great concern. So it has nothing to do with voluntary weight loss. Second, for the body composition, of course, what is aimed for with weight loss is to lose body fat and not to lose fat-free mass. So what is known is that the relative deficit in fat-free mass with weight loss will depend on a number of factors. One is your initial body fat. So the less fat you are when you lose weight, then you will lose a lot of fat-free mass, pointing to the fact that it might not be such a good idea to lose weight when you are not so fat. And the second issue is the caloric deficit. And it's known that with increasing caloric deficit, there will be increasing fat-free mass loss. And so this, I think, should be avoided as much as possible. And the method used for weight loss, we know that surgery is increasingly used to treat obesity. And this is true all over Europe. So it's very important to better know the composition of weight lost after surgery. And so there is some evidence that if dietary intake is maintained and there is some physical exercise, then the composition of the weight loss will be mostly fat mass, which is the aim of the procedure.
In the UK, but also in Europe, organisations ranging from the food industry to consumer protection NGOs have made commitments to help tackle current trends in diet and physical activity. In the UK, this is known as the Responsibility Deal. Susan Jebb has recently been appointed as Professor of Diet and Population Health in the Department of Primary Care Health Sciences, University of Oxford, and is also the independent chair of the Public Health Responsibility Deal Food Network. Professor Jebb explains what the Responsibility Deal is all about.
The Responsibility Deal is really a mechanism to bring a whole range of different partners together to try to improve the environment in which people live their lives. We know that many people aspire to live healthier lives, yet they persist in eating more than is good for them, drinking too much and so forth. And what we want to do is to change the environment in a way which makes it easier to make the healthier choices. And we believe that businesses and indeed some of the NGOs have a really important role to play in shifting the discourse and shifting the environment to make it easier for consumers. So far in relation to food, we've developed pledges which relate to calorie labelling on the high street, reductions in salt, the elimination of artificial trans fats, reductions in calories and increases in fruit and vegetables.
These pledges are delivered in a real-life setting, How are you evaluating the impact of the effort on public health outcomes?
It's really critical that we learn from what we're doing. This is a new way of working and we need to see if it's effective. We really lack good tools for measuring the food environment. So what we've done is to take a sort of multi-level approach to evaluation. The first element is just the transparency of the deal itself. Companies make public commitments and then they report against those commitments each year. And that actually is a very powerful mechanism for holding them to account. If we want to know whether those have made a difference, of course, we can make some calculations. For example, how much saturated fat might have been removed from the food supply chain with some of the reformulation activities. And so we certainly do those calculations. We're also continually measuring the diet of the nation through our ongoing programme of surveillance and monitoring. So there are a number of mechanisms by which we can begin to see whether we're making progress. The challenge for me is not whether we're achieving something. I think we're clearly doing something. The question is it as good as it possibly can be? And so the evaluation in part is about understanding the process and it's about developing the process so that we learn how best to incentivize companies to participate, how to raise the bar in setting really high quality pledges so that we have the best chance of delivering really the greatest impact for public health.
Could you give us some examples of the achievements of the responsibility deal?
We've seen a number of real successes. Across all of the pledges, we're asking companies to think really about four different things. What can they do to inform and educate consumers? What can they do about the product itself? What can they do in terms of access and availability of those healthier options? And is there more work that can be done in relation to promotion? So just to pull out a few examples, in relation to products, we've seen some fantastic work on reformulation. The UK has been working on salt reduction for a long time and we're seeing that continuing. We're just setting new salt targets. So we've seen salt in bread drop by 50%, similar reductions in breakfast cereals. We're now working specifically with the out-of-home sector to help them to catch up. And I hope we're very close to finalising a pledge which will see us set salt targets for some of the products on the high street. The soft drink industry has really stepped up to the plate and most of the big manufacturers have now made commitments to reduce the sugar content across their portfolio. And what that then does is it gives us a tool to go to other companies and say, look, if two or three big companies can do this, why can't you? So one of the great joys of the deal is that it allows the progressive companies to really innovate and do something new.
So that's a great incentive to get other parties on board. What other steps are you taking?
We've set out a very clear forward work plan for the network. That's really important because I don't want businesses to feel there's a never-ending list of asks. What we've done is to try to prioritise some key areas. And once we've got pledges in place for those, all of our efforts will go into simply deepening the quality and the extent of work in those areas. We've covered many of them already, but there are three which will roll out in the next year perhaps. The first will be a pledge on front of pack labelling. The second is a pledge which we've already drafted and we're just consulting on in relation to reductions in saturated fat. And then the third one is a bigger, and I know a complex piece of work, which is to identify some pledges around the promotion of food. That's important because that pledge will support work across a whole raft of other areas. We need to see a real shift in the promotional environment to encourage and motivate consumers to take up more of the healthier choices and, in fact, to consume less of the less healthy choices.
Food Today, science-based information on food, nutrition and safety. From UFIC, the European Food Information Council.